Hello everyone, my name is Elijah Davis, Minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, the 12th Hour, in Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is May 3, 2014, or the 5, 2018. We will start our third service today with a song entitled, Under His Wings. Under His Wings I'm safely abiding, though the night deepens and tempests are wild. Still I can trust Him, I know He will keep me. He has redeemed me, and I am His child. Under His wings, under His wings, who from His love can sever? Under His wings my soul shall abide, safely abide forever. Under His wings, what a refuge in sorrow! How the heart yearningly turns to His rest. Often when earth has no balm for my healing, there I find comfort, and there I am blessed. Under His wings, who from His love can sever? Under His wings my soul shall abide, safely abide forever. Under His wings, oh what precious enjoyment, there will I hide till life's trials are o'er. Sheltered, protected, no evil can harm me. Resting in Yahshua, I'm safe evermore. Under His wings, under His wings, who from His love can sever? Under His wings my soul shall abide, safely abide forever. Hello everyone, once again this is Elijah David. We're going to continue now with our study on Calling of the Vanguard, Brother Willis Liberty Johnson, 1998. We're on page 23. We're going to do a little review. And this is number 10 of our series. We're going to do a little review on page 23, paragraph 23. As correctly as heaven can make it, this symbolism depicts that the Elohim people in this final work are not to labor at cross purposes. All are to speak the same thing, so it is that His watchmen shall lift up the voice, with the voice together shall they sing, for they shall see eye to eye, and when the Yahshua shall bring again Zion, Isaiah 58, then His people shall be called the holy people, the redeemed of the Yahshua, sought out a city not forsaken. This city not forsaken is the New Jerusalem, folks. Isaiah 62:12. Now I want to point out that Brother Johnson is making this prophecy at Gilead Center in 1998, when the congregation was very much divided, with two groups of people represented there as a sheep and the goats, and they had been represented now at this time, since this time has already passed. They were represented as sheep and goats, two classes of people there at Gilead Center for 33 years that I was with Gilead Center. So he is saying then to Gilead Center in 1998, and we've only been on the scene about 28 years. He is telling them, he said, now, when Yahweh brings again Zion, or Yahshua brings again Zion, that we're going to all see eye to eye. making it obvious that we didn't see eye to eye at that time, and never did end up seeing eye to eye as a congregation. Okay? So we have to assume then that this is a proxy for the future church that is to come on the scene to succeed Gilead Center. And true enough, this is the way it turned out. Paragraph 24, it says, Joshua is well instructed that the burden and the ingenuity for the building of this spiritual temple belongs to him whose name is the branch. He is to go out of his place. To him be the glory. He alone is to be exalted. He is to build the temple of... Now this is Yahshua's temple. So now, is Yahshua going to grow up out of his place? Is he going to come down to this earth? And is he going to grow up out of his place now and build his temple? Okay. Now, the type for the building of Yahshua's temple was with Solomon after David's death. The covenant was made with David that house that his son is going to build is going to represent the everlasting kingdom of heaven. And it's going to be called the House of David. I can go to the Bible and show you where it's called the House of David. It's called the Everlasting Kingdom of David. Okay. And it says also further on down the prophecy that it's the same thing as the Everlasting Kingdom of the Yahshua. When he comes and sits upon the throne of David in the last days. That's why Yahshua comes in the last days and sits upon that throne, because it's everlasting. Okay, and then it's called the Everlasting Kingdom of Heaven. And who is the author of the Everlasting Kingdom of Heaven? The Father, Yahweh the Father. Okay. But as always, after man sinned, Yahweh has always had to choose righteous men here on earth. He had to first preordain them from the foundation of the world. He had to cause them to be created here on earth. And then he had to put his spirit in them, like Jeremiah and like Isaiah, from the birth. And they had to testify that from their birth they were called to this service. So he's always had to raise up visible leaders to carry out the plan of salvation and to build these physical and spiritual temples here on earth. So now, to more prove our point about this, let's go and read Amos chapter 9. I saw the... Now this is a latter-day prophecy for the 12th hour. All your prophets of the Old Testament prophesied mainly for the 12th hour, the last hour on the parabolic time clock. So how you measure it, this is what the prophecy was. For, and so it says in Amos 9 verse 1, I saw the Yahshua, the Son, stand upon the altar. Okay, and he said, smite the lintel of the door, that the posts may shake, and cut them in the head, all of them, and I will slay the last of them with the sword. Now, what does it say when Yahshua in these last days comes as the Apollyon, the exterminator of all his enemies? The New Testament scriptures calls him the Apollyon, meaning exterminated all of his people. Okay. So Yahshua is the slayer. And I will slay the last of them with a sword. We know that in Revelation 19, he comes as a man on a white horse to do war and battle. And it says they're destroyed by the sword of his mouth. Okay, in Hebrews 4:12. And I will slay the last of them with a sword. What sword? The sword of his mouth, Hebrews 4:12. He that fleeth of them shall not flee away, and he that escapeth of them shall not be delivered. Though they dig into hell, thence shall mine hand take them. Though they climb up into heaven, thence will I bring them down. And though they hide themselves in the top of the Carmel, I will search and take them out thence. And though they be hid from my sight in the bottom of the sea, fence without a command of a serpent, and he shall bite them. And though they go into the captivity before their enemies, thence will I command the sword, and it shall slay them. And I will set mine eyes upon them for evil and not for good. And the Yahshua, Messiah of the host, is the one that touches the land. Now this is Yahshua. He's the Yahweh of hosts. And it shall melt, and all that dwell therein shall mourn, and it shall rise up wholly like a flood, and shall be drowned as by the flood of Egypt. It is he that buildeth the stories in the heaven. Okay, and hath founded his troop in the earth. Who is his troop? 144,000. Okay. He that calleth for the waters of the sea and poureth them out upon the face of the earth. The Yahshua is his name. Are you not as children of the Ethiopians unto me, O children of Israel? Saith the Yahweh. Have not I brought up Israel out of the land of Egypt? Now we know that Yahshua is the one that directly was with Moses, bringing the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt. Peter says that 1 Corinthians 10, he says that Yahshua was that rock in the cloud that went with Moses. He was that one in the burning bush that called Moses aside and gave him a commission to go down into Egypt. It's time to go now to deliver the children of Israel, and Yahshua went with him. We need to get used to this Yahshua. He's the deliverer. Okay. And the Philistines from Captor, and the Assyrians from Kir. Behold, the eyes of the Yahweh Elohim, we'll go to the Father here on this one, are upon the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy from off the face of the earth, saving that I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob. Okay, so here's the house of Jacob that is residing in this sinful kingdom. What kingdom? The one where he was born in. And typical Jacob was born in the sinful kingdom of Gilead Center in 1970. Okay. And he says, for lo, I will command, and I will sift the house of Israel among all nations. Now here is Yahweh going to all nations, and he's going to sift all nations. He's going to sift the house of Israel among all nations. Like as corn is sifted in a sieve, yet shall not the least grain fall upon the earth. So if there's anybody there represented by the grain, and that's the wheat grain, it's not going to fall upon the earth. It's going to be retained in the sieve. All the chaff and the rest of the other stuff is going to be taken out from among the grain. And all nations, all the sinners of my people shall die by the sword. So it makes no difference what nation they're in, what church they're in around the world. If they're in one of the houses of Israel that's being sifted, then he says, all the sinners of my people shall die by the sword. And what determines a sinner? Those who don't keep Yahshua's commandments of the sanctuary system, as he has instructed them to do. First he makes them to know his commandments and statutes and judgment, how they apply in the New Testament. And then he teaches them how to observe and keep his commandments and statutes the way that he can approve of. So this is how he determines who are sinners. If you go around saying that Jesus is very God, then you're adding to and taking away from the inspired word. And so the Bible don't teach that. So where do you get the authority to teach it? Or man, where does man get the authority to change Yahweh's inspiration on his doctrine and say that Jesus is very God? Okay. All the sinners of my people shall die by the sword, which say the evil shall not overtake nor prevent us. That's what they were saying down at Kermit. There's several words that they would never use down at Kermit. And one word you never heard ever come out of their mouth is a word called sin. You never heard another word called repentance. You never hear these key words. I remember Alan one time said, we need a revival reformation. That's the only time I ever heard out of the mouth outside of myself in the church, calling for a revival reformation. The rest of them, what do we need a revival reformation for? Well, we're fine like we are. Okay, and to prove my point, brothers come to see me one day. We had a private conversation in my backyard. And finally I asked him, I said, well, no, I didn't ask him. He said, my wife is the most perfect person I've ever met in my life. And he said, I said, oh, you don't, is that the reason why you never acknowledge a fault or a wrong? Because you don't believe you make any and you don't believe you commit sin. And he said that, I asked him, I said, are you above sin? And he just flat come out and told me that he and his wife were above sin. Okay, just flat told me that. And I said, but I had to ask him. He acknowledged, yeah, we're above sin. He said, otherwise we wouldn't be called to head up this work. And I said, that's the reason why you never acknowledge when you make a mistake or anything. You're above sin. Okay. I rest my case on that one. It says in verse 11 of Amos 9, in that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen. Well, when was it raised up the first place in our day? 1970. And Willis Johnson took advantage of a favorable opportunity and stepped into a prophetic interval time, because he was the most likely person to fill that position in 1970. And so therefore he did, and he raised up the tabernacle of David. That was a temple, a spiritual temple. And but he didn't do it without some help. Yahshua, or Yahweh the Father, appeared to him through the Spirit and said, raise up a temple. Raise up the tabernacle. Raise up the sanctuary. And put Yahweh's people back on true time. I'll make me a creation calendar, that they may know when to keep the correct days at the right time. And then teach my people my government. Okay? So that was all that was given to Brother Johnson to do, was to make a creation calendar, put Yahweh's people back on true time, and teach them my government. That's the only two commissions that was ever given to Brother Johnson. Well, I'll tell you one thing. He did Brother Johnson more of a treat than he did his predecessor, Ben Roden. Ben Roden didn't go on record as saying, well, after V.T. Holliff died, and the spirits came to me and told me that I was to take his place and continue on with the Rod period, and that I was to teach that I'm the antitypical David, and that I am to gather the 144,000 and lead them into the land. That's what he taught, but he never said that. That's what Ben Roden essentially taught, but he never said a word. He just took over the reins and just started saying things and doing things, and so there you have it. So anyway, Ben Roden attempted to raise up the tabernacle of David. And so much so he had himself crowned King David after he got it raised up in 1970 at Pentecost. Brother Johnson, that's the same year Brother Johnson was due to succeed Ben Roden and to take over this tabernacle of David. So essentially Ben Roden showed Brother Johnson how to raise up this tabernacle of David. Because he'd been practicing this tabernacle of David for 10 years. Ben Roden had raised up this tabernacle of David in his own way of thinking 10 years earlier, in 1960, while he was still in the Rod period. So if Brother Johnson needed any kind of a semblance of a pattern, he could have looked to Ben Roden, because Ben Roden restored the daily. And they were keeping it faithfully at the 9 and the 3 o'clock. Every day. They kept it faithfully. And so Brother Johnson really had a pattern from Ben Roden, that he was supposed to restore the day. And so when Brother Johnson took over and raised up Creation Counter and put it in operation in 1970, first thing he did was restore the David and the sacred name. He went a step further than Ben Road, and he restored the sacred name. He restored the health laws. He restored all the other additional feast days of the seventh-day Sabbath. He restored the Matthew 18 doctrine of forgiveness between the brethren so that they could come into unity. He restored five ordinances, doctrines, at the beginning of his ministry in 1970. And not a one of them did him a bit of good. Because when his ministry was closing, coming to a close, what happened? Yeshua come and visited the house at Gilead Center, found a servant eating and drinking with a drunken and smiting his fellow servants, and so he just come and took the reins in his own hand and kept the old servant, the slothful servant, asunder, and appointed his portion of the hypocrites and put him out to pasture, and called his new servant, Antipical David, which was in the spirit and power of Elijah, to raise up this tabernacle of David that had completely fallen down again. Brother Johnson hasn't helped Ben Roden, showed him how to raise it up, and then Brother Johnson got some help from Yahshua that came personally in 1968 and 69, 2 years ahead of time, and prepared Brother Johnson to raise up this tabernacle, and he did indeed raise it up, put it into full operation, and was happy in perfecting the creation calendar. It took him 7 years to perfect it, and he was happy every step of the way, and we rejoiced in those first 7 years that Brother Johnson was building this temple, a spiritual temple. We rejoiced in it. Every time new light would open up on the tabernacle, we would rejoice in it, just have a thrilling good time. So anyway, so now the prophecy of Amos says that his servant's going to have to raise up this tabernacle that has fallen down, and close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old. Okay. So if you had ruins in the days of old, then you had ruins in the Anatot as well. There had to be a time when the tabernacle of David was rebuilt, raised up, and then there had to be a time again in the Anatot where it had to be trodden down again, type and Anatot. And then you had to have it where it would be raised up again after it was trodden down a second time in the Anatot. Okay, so I said, the reason why you raise up the tabernacle of David is that they may possess the remnant of Edom. And who was Edom? The remnant of Edom was found right there at Gilead Center, because Edom represents the office of the Adventist Church altogether. And Mount Gilead was a mouthpiece for that office. Okay, verse 12. That they may possess the remnant of Edom and of all the heathen which are called by my name, saith the Yahweh that doeth this. Behold, the days come, saith the Yahweh, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of the grapes him that soweth seed, and the mountains shall drop sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. And I will bring again the captivity of my people, which is the 144,000. And they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof. They shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them, and I will plant them upon their land, and they shall no more be pulled up out of their land which I have given them, saith the Yahweh thy Savior, or Yahshua thy Savior. Alright, now, he says that I will bring again the captivity of my people Israel. Now, who is the captivity of his people Israel? It's the ancient Israel that died and went into the grave, being faithful to the sanctuary service of Moses. All of the ancient Israel that died in the faith back then were of the captivity of Israel. Okay. Now, they're resurrected in these last days, and he's going to bring them again back to their land where they originally were born in. And when they went in their graves, they were for the full faith that they were going to come forth out of that grave one day, and they were going to meet their Redeemer, because he was following the blood system before they went in the grave, and that's the captivity of my people Israel. Okay, and then the 144,000 are your captivity in the Anatot. They get it out of all nations where they've been scattered. He said he's going to sift the nations among, going to gather the remnant and sift the nations like he would you do a corn in a sieve. And now the grease grain is going to fall upon the ground. Ezekiel 20 says he's going to gather them out of all nations, his remnant. He's going to bring the abundance of people. So here's Amos 9 and Ezekiel 20 collaborating on the same thing, and Jeremiah 23. All of them talking about the same thing. Okay. So now, this brings us to where we're at here in our study for this afternoon. We're on number 10. We're on page 23 of the tract Calling the Vanguard by Brother Study Johnson. It says, paragraph 25, Zechariah 3, 13 and 15. Even he shall build the temple of the Yahshua. Now, whether you realize or not, that Zechariah's whole prophecy is about this here antichrist David and about him being the angel of the Yahweh before the people. This whole book of Zechariah is really talking about this visible servant David that's going to be raised up, that's going to do this thing right before their eyes. And he shall bear the glory and shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne. Well, okay, if this is just talking about Yahshua, well then, Yahshua was raised up 2,000 years ago, and he'd already taken his position on this throne 2,000 years ago. Okay. So what's he doing then coming back here 2,000 years later and repeating stuff that he'd already done? No, he's got to repeat it with his underservant. Okay. And the council of peace shall be between them both. Okay. Who's this both? Yahshua is the one that comes and orchestrates the rebuilding of the temple. He proved that in 2002 at Trumbull, Texas, when he came and took the reins in his own hands there. Luke 19 is a parable on it. And it says that Yahshua is this one that came, made a change of the guard, and raised up the tabernacle of David with his visible servant David, put him in charge, and went back to heaven. It says here in Luke 19. And they that are far off shall come and build in the temple of the Yahshua, and you shall know the Yahshua of the host has sent me unto you. And this shall come to pass, if you will diligently obey the voice of the Yahshua your Savior. Paragraph 26. Now why do I keep referring to obeying Yahshua's voice? Because here in John 15:10. He's telling the disciples, if you keep my commandments, you shall abide in my love. Even as I've kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. If you do everything that I tell you and teach you, happy are you. He said, I please my Father because I speak only his words and I do always those things that please him. So if you as my chosen disciples do all those things that please me, happy are you. See, it's just it's a progressive state. Okay, it's a hierarchy state here. Paragraph 26. This shall the prophecies of Isaiah chapter 2 and 4, also the fourth chapter of Micah, be fulfilled. The text of the TGR 1, chapter 28, page 15, reveals that the shepherd rod message, therefore, is the one that precedes the harvest of the earth. Okay. The shepherd rod message is the one that precedes the harvest of the earth. So, then what is that shepherd rod message that precedes the harvest of the earth? It's the message of the Isaac branch that Rose Johnson put in charge of as a third feeding pasture for of the Adventist, Mount Gilead, in 1970. This is the shepherd rod message, therefore, that precedes the harvest in the 12th hour. And when was this message given? It was given in the 11th hour by the Brother Stephen Johnson. He's the one in charge of the shepherd rod message, the one that precedes the harvest of the earth. He's saying that V.T. Holliff was the one in charge of that message. But V.T. Holliff did not have the Isaac branch message. That's the message that precedes the harvest. Okay, because it's antiquity lies to declaring it and calling for a revival and reformation and closing out the old movement and the old church, the sinful kingdom. Elijah comes on the scene and declares revival and reformation and closes out the sinful kingdom of Gilead in the 11th hour and opens up the 12th hour for the Mount of Zion at the 12th hour, the house of David, to take charge. Because it's a purified church by now, because they're embracing purified doctrine and they're in unity. Those that makes up this house of David are totally in unity. And if they're not in unity, then that's what the Passover is for. To bring everybody into unity of the truth, of doctrine, and of the Spirit. And to be in total unity with one another. That's what the Passover is for. And if this can't happen, you have to then vet everybody before the Passover service, now that we're in the judgment of living. And if they don't agree on all points of the doctrine, then they can't take the supper together. Okay? So it says, the harvest of the earth, the great and dreadful day of Yahweh, the judgment for the living, the day in which all things are to be restored. Okay? And the day that all things are to be restored. Now, what does that mean, all things are to be restored? You've got to repair the waste cities. Okay, those that are going to be resurrected from ancient Israel are going to come back into their own land, and they're going to repair and rebuild the waste cities. The resurrected ones. In the 12th hour. Why are they designated to do that? Because those that are harvesting in the 12th hour are harvesters. They don't have time to go and build the old waste cities. Besides, it wasn't their cities to rebuild. It belonged to ancient Israel. The 144,000 and those that are in the 12th hour, they have one job. They're harvesters. They have to go and harvest. Okay? So it says, restore all things, and including building these old waste cities. That includes restoring all of the sanctuary system back to its rightful order with the daily in place and with Judah in charge and commanded to keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows so the wicked shall no longer pass through thee. He's utterly cut off. This is the job of the those that are ahead of the kingdom. They're not to go and build the old ways. And all their workmen are soldiers. They're soldiers that's going to go and harvest their brethren. So it says, precedes the harvest of the earth, the great and dreadful day of Yahweh, the judgment for the living, the day in which all things are to be restored, Mark 9:12, and 1 TGR 4, page 61, paragraph 2 reads, behold upon the mountains the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publishes peace. O Judah, keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows. Rose Johnson got in parentheses the truth of the sanctuary. Yeah, that would have been mighty good if he had understood the pure truth of the sanctuary and articulated it. Had been wonderful. We'd still been together today. For the wicked shall no more pass through thee, he is utterly cut off. Nahum 1:15. We are therefore made to realize that the two branches coming on the scene, back to back, two branches. Well, it says, back to back is proof that the Ishmael Isaac typology has met fulfillment right here in our day. Well, I'm going to ask you something. Where in the type did they say that Ishmael represented the branch? See, that's another thing you got to consider. Bruce Johnson said the two branches meet back to back. But in the type and in the prophecy, Ishmael was never pointed out as being connected with the branch. Only Isaac, the second born son of Abraham, was prefigured Yahshua only. He's the only one that prefigured Yahshua, which has another name, the branch. Ishmael didn't prefigure no branch. He was born of the flesh. Only those that are born of the Spirit can prefigure the branch. Isaac was born of the Spirit. So you see, just because Ben Rudin was teaching the branch, which he didn't have a permission to do. He had no authority from the scriptures to do this. He had no authority from the prophets. He didn't point out anything like this that he taught during the rod period. So where did Ben Rudin get this branch thing? Just because B.D. Hollis said before he died, the next great movement would be called the branch. And that's the only thing he had to go on. So he's saying that when V.T. Hollis died, instead of Ben Rudin taking the rod books as his textbooks, because the three volumes of the Severed Rod had been completed by V.T. Hollis, instead of taking all that and gleaning all the wonderful projected prophecies out of there for the future, that's what I'm doing. I'm using V.T. Hollis as a textbook to unfold all of these prophecies during the 12th hour. And I'm using Brother Johnson as the last connecting link of the rod to get this thing done now. We are therefore made to realize that the two branches coming on the scene back to back is proof that the Ishmael-Isaac topology has met fulfillment. Well, that may have a point there. He may have a point since we did identify Ben Rudin with the branch as being the Ishmael branch. We identified him as being the antithetical Ishmael, so really that makes sense for us in these last days to treat it that way. I can see how Brother Johnson treated it that way, all right. But the Bible sure don't project it or teach that in prophecy or anything. Right here in our day, that those who refuse to keep Yahweh's solemn feast, Leviticus 23, are classed as a wicked and are cut off. Well, Ben Rudin was keeping Yahweh's solemn feast and performing the daily to the best of his knowledge, but it wasn't with the knowledge according to the law of Moses. He wasn't doing that. So I guess you would say that he was doing it from his own invented knowledge. Let's go on. Brother Johnson is talking here. We just can't sweep these facts under the rain, under the rug. We have to deal with them with an open mind. Now, Brother Johnson is going to go into our next topic called the golden candlestick. Thou saw still that a stone was cut out without the hands, which smote the image upon his feet, that were the iron and clay, and break them to pieces. And in the days of these kings shall the Elohim of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left unto other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Now, did you notice anything while you was reading along there with me? Did you notice anything left out? Alan, are you awake? It says that thou sawest still that a stone was cut out without hands. Now, if you were to go and read it from the Bible, just the way the Bible has it, you'd read it like this. Thou sawest still that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands. So I don't know whether Brother Johnson's in a hurry or whether he didn't think it mattered or not, but he left out, cut out of the mountain without him, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and break them to pieces. And in the days of these kings shall the Elohim of heaven set up a kingdom. I've read these scriptures so many times that I can tell you this on these, the ones that I'm really familiar with, I can tell you when words are left out. It just don't have the same ring to it. Okay, it says... Okay, we have a little correction to make here. I said that he left out...
I thought that too, but...
It's cut out of the mountain without hands. Actually, that's in verse 44 of Daniel 2. The verse Johnson is actually quoting from Daniel 2, 34, and 44 of... It doesn't say mountain in either one of those verses, but in verse 45 it does, but Brother Johnson didn't quote 45, so I stand corrected on that. All right. So anyway, it says, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left unto other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Daniel 2, 35 and 44. There it is. He has it there. From this text of the scriptures, we conclude that in the last days, the Elohim of the heaven will set up a kingdom church. Okay, he had it down here now. He says, a little stone cut out of the mountain. Okay. So he does take in verse 45 there by what he just said now. He says that mountain was SDA and the BSDA. Well, he's right, because the BSDA is the same thing as SDA. They're one and the same. Because DSDA is in charge of the candlestick, not SDA, and so whoever's in charge of the candlestick is the leader of the church. And so, from 1930 on, the tribe of Judah, the house of David, the Davidians, were in charge of the candlestick, not the Seventh-day Adventist. So, the little stone cut out of the mountain would be cut out of the Davidian Seventh-day Adventist mountain. And it just so happens that the prophecy shows now that the Mount Gilead was the third mountain of that chain of the Seventh-day Adventist. There was a chain of three mountains, Bashan, Carmel, and Gilead. Bashan belonged exclusively to the SDA, whereas Mount Carmel belonged to the DSDA, and Mount Gilead belonged to DSDA. Those two mountains, but the first one, Bashan, belonged to SDA exclusively. Okay, but keep in mind that SDA and Davidians, Seventh-day Adventists, the Rod, from 1937, and the Branch Davidians, Mount Gilead, from 1970 to 2010, are all three treating pastors that came forth in the 10th and the 11th hour. Now, SDA and Davidian Seventh-day Adventist, the Rod, came forth in the 10th hour, whereas the Branch Davidians came forth in the 11th parabolic hour, but they were all three part of those fourth group of laborers that is called at the 9th hour in Matthew 20, verse 5, where it says that they were called at the ninth hour. In other words, at the close of the 9th hour. So, no matter who is in charge, there are still all seven dead men, three feeding pastures, and the judgment of the dead period. And the three angels' messages is all that all three of those feeding pastures had. That's all they ended up with. And you don't purify a congregation with three angels' messages. You've got to have that fourth and fifth that comes on the scene to do their mighty work before you can see a purified people with the three seals, as pointed out in Revelation 3:12. Okay, so it says the little stone cut out of the mountain, SDA, DSDA, and Rose Johnson is definitely a part of that DSDA, and so it was shown then that since he was the last part of that DSDA, then that little stone was cut out of Mount Gilead and not Mount Carmel, or it wasn't cut out of Mount Bashan. It was cut out of Mount Gilead. And when was it cut out? At the closing and the ending of the 11th parabolic hour, at the going down of the sun on Gilead Center, and closing out the judgment of the dead, and probation closing for the Seventh-day Adventist Church, for Ellen G. White prophesied in Volume 3 of the Testimony, page 266 and 267, she says the closing work for the Seventh-day Adventist Church is the ceiling of the 144,000. Assuming that 144,000 are already sealed, then you would have to conclude then that the Adventist Church work has come to a close. So if you feel like you've got to go back to the Adventist laity and try to make contact and make Bible studies with them, if you feel like that you've got to do all this, well, then you're going back to a dried up feeding pasture. Okay. There's no life there in those feeding pastures. Matter of fact, you know something else? When the feeding pasture dries up, there's no living flock in that feeding pasture that are alive. There's nothing live left in that feeding pasture. Once it dries up, the flock leaves out. There's no life in those feeding pastures once they dry up. That's the reason why when they rejected the message of John's writing in 1888, in 1890 there, when the Adventists rejected Jones and Ryder, those that rejected Jones and Ryder, they didn't all reject Jones and Ryder, but there was a remnant that didn't. That stayed with Ellen G. White and Jones and Ryder and continued on, but there was those that didn't. Mount Bashan dried up. Sister White says, that she was instructed that there was no more new light to come to the people, to the Advent. From her pen of inspiration, there was yet not another word of new light until they make use of the old light that they've already had. You're getting not another ray of light from me. And so Mount Basin dried up. And where did the prophecy take the time after that? Went into a spiritual fast for Judah by Ezekiel 4 for the next 40 years. And what about Mount Basin? She dried up. Where did the people that dried up with her, where did they go? They went with the General Conference leadership of Seventh-day Adventists. They stayed with her. And what did the General Conference teach them the next 40 years? Did they teach them the understanding of Jones and Wright's message, righteousness by faith? Did they try to accentuate on that and explain that? No. They called it a false, they called them false prophets, they called it a false message, and they never acknowledged it as being any benefit for the Advent. But those that stayed with Ellen G. White, they acknowledged it. But they only had one thing to feed on, and that was Ellen G. White's writings up to 1890. They couldn't feed on any more writings from Ellen G. White after 1890, even the remnant that stayed with Ellen G. White and Jones and Wright. So what did they have to feed on? They had to feed on old provender that Sister White had published between 1850, the birth of testimonies, to 1890. That's all they had to feed on. They had to go back and feed on that over and over and over. And whatever she taught on during that time, that's all they had to feed on. They had no new life. But what they do? So they went into a spiritual fast with Ezekiel for Judah for 40 years. So the Adventists went for 40 years from 1890 to 1930 with no new truth published for them. All they got was Taylor G. Bunch, 40 years in the wilderness, showing them where that they were going through that 40-year wilderness that Moses went through the second 40 years of his life. That they were in the antitype of that. Taylor G. Bunch showed them. Says, you're in a 40-year wilderness. Okay. So the Adventists had to just sit back, rock back, and be content to then follow the leaders that was in that 40 years, and that was Taylor G. Bunch. And he published a lot of good stuff now. So those that stayed with Ellen G. White continued on with Taylor G. Bunch and M.L. Anderson, because he published Isaiah the Gospel Prophet, so he published stuff in the 20s for them to feed on, the Adventists. And V.T. Hollis was sure feeding on it whenever he discovered the Rod message in 1928 and 29. He was feeding on those feeder bookish of M.L. Anderson, a high up minister in the Adventist Church of the General Conference. He was in the General Conference favor. And so that's what the Adventists did in that 40-year spiritual fast for Judah and Ezekiel 4. That's what they fed on. Stuff that those leaders in the wilderness had to feed them. And what those leaders in the wilderness showed them what they were missing out on for the future. Okay? So Yahweh sent a message by M.L. Anderson, still during the Advent, that 40-year period, to rescue the remnant that had followed Ellen G. White into that 40-year wilderness, to rescue them out of the wilderness. And it was V.T. Hollis that was sent as a rescuer to publish the Rod and the interpretation of those 13 chapters of Emil Anderson publishing those three little books, Isaiah the Gospel Prophet, that was published in the Sabbath School Quarterly in 1928 and 29. I believe it was in 1929 they published those three little booklets in January, February, and March of that quarterly of that year. Hollis was teaching from it. He was a Sabbath school teacher in the Adventist Church. He was teaching from that. And boy, he was uncovering this new light. And they got wind of it, and they come and listen to him. The leaders did in his classes. They said, you can't teach that here. He said, well, your man is the one that publishes. I don't care. You can't teach that interpretation here. So he said, well, so that's what broke up V.T. Hollis, and that's how he got launched into the Shepherd Rod in 1930. Okay, and so then with a new message, with a new and the second step of this genuine movement of Seventh-day Adventists with Mount Carmel, a second feeding pasture opened up. Now you have a lush feeding pasture with fields of grain. I mean, the grass is belly high, and the people can go now and rejoice in a fresh new feeding pasture for Israel. Those that have been faithful, stayed with the truth from day one, then they went right on into the rod, and so the ones that made up the membership of the Shepherd's Rod in 1930 on was all out of the Adventist Church. Okay. And so, you know what happened? Shepherd Rod had a 40-year period, and Vicki Hallis died in the first 25 years of that. He died. He had 15 years left. His successor, Ben Roden, took it over. And what did he do? He flat destroyed the rod and the relevance of the rod in the eyes of the people, and the sheep scattered all over the world. For the Shepherd Rod, they had institutions in other countries, not just the United States. And so the people, they left Old Mount Carmel, and they just went and formed their own feeding pastures in Missouri and California and New York and elsewhere, Jamaica. And they formed here and there, and they formed at least a dozen places. They called it the True Shepherd Rod. And Ben Roden stayed at the New Mount Carmel in Waco, in that area, calling himself the true successor, and all the time he was preaching a whole new movement within a movement, and another message I call the branch. Out of time, out of order. He had no commission to do it, but he did anyway. So anyway, it says, the little stone cut out of the mountain, DSDA, and according to the Shepherd Rod message, it is the one that is set before antitypical Joshua. And of course, Brother Stubbs Johnson don't go and say this is Joshua the son of Josedek. I guess he wants everybody to assume that there's just only one Joshua, and that he was entitled Joshua the son of Nun in 1970, so I guess he wants everybody to think that there's just one Joshua really involved here, and that he's this Joshua from day one. He says the messenger of the 11th hour and the 12th hours. All right, now he's partially right here. He says, the little stone cut out of the mountain, SDA, is the one that is set before antitypical Joshua. Now the truth of this matter is, this little stone represents the kingdom of David, the everlasting kingdom of heaven, with David as the leader of it. Okay? And so it is set before Joshua, the son of Josedek, the one that's closing out the 11th hour. The Brother Johnson said, it is the one that is set before antitypical Joshua, the messenger of the 11th and 12th hours. Well, Joshua, the son of Nun, is a messenger of the 11th hour. That's what Brother Johnson titled in 1970. And he published that. But the messenger of the 12th hour is Joshua, the son of Josedek. So in all fairness, he should have said there's two Joshuas involved here. And he should have said just what I said. He certainly had the information to do that. He certainly could have done that if he'd have wanted to. But he certainly had the facts and the information, because he lived out these facts himself. So he says, and since it is a kingdom church that fills the whole earth, okay. Well, this mountain of the house of Yahweh, Isaiah 2 and Micah 4, which is the house of David, yes, it's this everlasting kingdom in Daniel 2:45 that shall never be destroyed or left to other people, but it shall grow into a mountain and fill the whole earth. Now, this is that kingdom. But you see, he don't go on and tell you that. He just lets you imagine that it's his kingdom of the 11th hour that's going to do all this stuff. And that he's this Joshua, that he's this antitypical Joshua, and that he's a servant of the 11th and the 12th hour. But yet he's teaching all the time, up to 1998, that the 11th hour was the last parabolic hour. I heard him say in the pulpit one day, there's going to be a separating of the sheep and the goats when we stand on Mount Zion with the Lamb in Yeah, at the end of the 11th hour. And he says, at the end of the 11th hour, we're going to stand on Mount Zion of the Lamb. And that's going to begin begin the 12th hour in the land. Well, I don't know where he's going from that. He talked like that we're already home. We're in the everlasting kingdom of heaven in the 12th hour. And then he don't go and say, well, what are we going to do in the 12th hour? The 12th is for the harvest. This is when action really begins. This is when you have the great time of trouble like there never was since it was a nation. This is when Michael stands up to deliver the saints. This is when the four winds of strife are let loose. This is when the four angels that are given to loose the winds to hurt those that turn the four winds loose on us. I mean, there's a thousand things that are going to, millions of things going to take place in this 12th hour. There's going to be the resurrection of everybody from the 11th hour back down to the first hour. Cure back to Adam and Eve. You're going to have all of Ezekiel's resurrection of the Valley of Dry Bones. You're going to have all. And what does he do? He says, Antipo Joshua is a messenger of the 11th and the 12th hour. That's all he said. And since it is a kingdom that fills the whole earth, it would therefore be represented by an instrument with the number 10. It being a church, we would have to find a biblical instrument with the number 10 to represent it, because the number 10 is a universal number, and a kingdom church filling the whole earth would have to be a church represented by the universal number of 10. As we look at the Elohim's church, Israel, in the time of the David and Solomon, we see the temple built by the Solomon as instructed by the Elohim with a candlestick in the first apartment, which represented the church Israel. And it stands as number one of the Old Testament. Okay. As the number one of the Old Testament, which was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, with the 70 years of captivity, which at the end of that period, the Jews, see, he says the Jews, he doesn't say the tribe of Judah. He doesn't separate the tribe of Judah from the 10 tribes that went into captivity 120 some years before, you see. And besides, that first candlestick that Solomon put there in the temple when he built and dedicated that temple of David, that first candlestick was set up with Adam and Eve. Because that's where the sanctuary system was first put in operation, with Adam and Eve after they sinned. And that sanctuary system certainly had a candlestick in it. So if you're going to talk about the first candlestick of the 10, you have to start with that one, that first sanctuary system that was set up with Adam and Eve after they sinned. So let's go on. It says, as we look at the Elohim's congregation, Israel, in the time of David and Solomon, we see that the temple built by the Solomon, as instructed by the Elohim, with a candlestick in the first apartment, which represented the church Israel, and it stands as number one of the Old Testament, which was destroyed by the Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylon, and 70 years of the captivity, which at the end of that period, the Jews were set free to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple called the Second Temple of Israel. The Second Temple of the Old Testament dispensation, as pointed out on the temple type and antitype chart by the Vitti Halep, let us now turn to Revelation 1, 12, and 20, which points out that John heard a voice behind him, and in the turning to see from where the voice was coming, he saw seven golden candlesticks. The voice told him to write the things which he has seen, and the things which shall be hereafter, saying that the seven candlesticks which he has seen were the seven churches which were in Asia, Revelation 1:4. Let us now count the candlesticks, that two in the Old Testament dispensation and seven in Asia. In the New Testament, this assertion makes none. Thus we have to search for number 10, and looking at the candlestick seen by John the Revelator, we see that it represents Laodicea, or the SDA-DSDA church as previously proven by the Shepherd Rod message. Thus we have to look beyond the SDA-DSDA movement and their allotted time elements to the Joshua Isaac branch period, which the White House recruiter page 53 shows is the Elohim denomination of the day, which according to the type follows the Shepherd Rod movement. Okay. So if he had said follows the Davidian movement, then he'd had to include himself into that because he was the last of the Davidian movement, the Mount Gilead. So you see, it's a matter of using the right word for the right reason. The pre-harvest, pre-judgment, and TGR 28:15, page 15, reveals that the Shepherd Rod message precedes the harvest of the earth. Well, the harvest of the earth in the 12th hour and the 11th hour divisions, Gilead Center, had the pre-harvest message for the 12th hour. The great invisibility of it. The Brother Johnson thought the 10th hour was a pre-harvest period that Vitaly was in, and that he was the harvest period in the 11th hour, and yet you have one more hour left when designated literally for the harvest of all the earth clear back to Adam and Eve. Okay, so it says, the great invisibility of Yahweh, the judgment for the living, the day in which all things are to be restored. So we're in the judgment of the living, we're in the 12th parabolic hour, and Yahweh now has opened up enough new information here after the Passover 2014, where now we can build faithfully on this and completely restore this everlasting kingdom of the heaven, which is Camp David, the everlasting a kingdom of David, which is the same thing as the everlasting kingdom of heaven, that Yahweh the Father and his son and antitypical Elijah David are in charge of bringing forth the prophecies that the inspiration from the Almighty articulated to his living visible servant here on earth, antitypical Elijah. I'm just going to leave it at that. And so these prophecies have to be uncovered and understood and developed and interpreted by his lone messenger, Elijah. Whomever that character may be in the eyes of anyone, nevertheless, he is an individual character. He is a very visible, live individual. And he appears in the everlasting kingdom of heaven. And he is the one that is bringing the message of revival, reformation that will turn the hearts of the father to the children and the children to the father, unless he comes and smite the earth with a curse. He's going to come and smite the earth with a curse if this Elijah don't affect this revival and reformation. This brings the curve of studies. All you can contact us at the 11th hour call. And that's number 11. Click on our audio archives. Hear this message and more. We will close now with a song. And is my name written there? Thou cannot for riches, neither silver nor gold, have it make sure of heaven, have it enter the fold. In the book of thy kingdom, with its pages so fair, tell me, Yahshua, my Savior, my name written there. Is my name written there on the page white and fair, the book of the kingdom? Is my name written there? Now my sins they are many, like the sands of the sea, but the blood of my Savior is sufficient for me. For the promise is written in thy letters that flow, though your sins be as scarlet, I will make them like snow. Is my name written there on the page white and fair in the book of thy kingdom? Is my name written there?
utterly forsaken, with his mansions of light, with his glorified beings and pure garments of white. When no evil thing cometh to destroy his birth, where the angels are waiting, is my name written there? Is my name written there on the page white and fair in the book of thy kingdom? Is my name written there?